Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable, a special New Year's Eve edition of the programme when I'm going to be joined by a couple of female guests on the show. Look forward to introducing them to you. Some important stories to be told about theology and real life in the real world. I'll be joined a bit later on the show by Jessica Kelly, talking about the unusual circumstances that led her to write her book, Lord Willing. And a little bit later on by Sarah Foster as well, who's an apologist with Fanda Apologetics, and going to be talking about her interactions with Muslims in London. So lots to look forward to this Saturday afternoon. I do hope that however you're listening around the world, perhaps via the podcast or indeed this Saturday afternoon via our broadcast here on Premier Christian Radio, that you enjoy today's show, that you have a very happy new year as well. We'll be hearing some of your feedback, of course, later on in the programme. Look forward to hearing what you've had to say about recent editions of the show, and I'll be inviting you to tell me what you'd like to see on Unbelievable in 2017. Are there topics, guests, things that you'd like us to discuss here on the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate? Don't forget, you can find out more about the show and the last year's worth, in fact, the last nearly 10 years worth of shows in the back catalogue at the website, premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. Let's get into today's programme. You're unbelievable. Well, joining me today on the programme for the first section of today's show is Jessica Kelly. She featured recently in Premier Christianity magazine in the real life section of the mag. This is in the December edition. Did God give my 4-year-old son brain cancer? Was the rather harrowing title of that particular piece. Based on her book, Lord Willing, Wrestling with God's Role in My Child's Death. And Jessica has a story to tell about receiving devastating news about her son's health when he was just 4 years old. And she couldn't stomach the usual Christian cliches about God's role in suffering. Well, in the article, she tells Sam Hales her story, but we're going to be hearing it from her in person on today's programme. So, Jessica, a very warm welcome and welcome along to Unbelievable.
Thank you so much, Justin. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you on the line. Now, we were hoping to get you via Skype, but at the time I tried to call you, the technology has let us down. You can never always rely on technology, can you? As I'm sure.
No, it's great when it works. But
that's what they say, isn't it? Yeah. Look, thank you for joining me on the program today, Jessica, because we did, when we first started corresponding, talk about you perhaps coming in for a standard kind of dialogue version of the show. But obviously, because of the nature of the subject of what we're talking about, we felt maybe a one-to-one interview would work better. I first came across you, Jessica, when I heard you contributing to a talk at Greg Boyd's church in Minnesota. I think that you were invited to share your story a few years ago there at the church. Have you kind of long had a kind of an association with Greg Boyd, his teaching and his theology?
You know, I encountered the podcast sermons at Woodland Hills after I started having children. So in my late 20s, early 30s, before that, I had been raised a very traditional Christian family, and I had always subscribed to what I call in the book the blueprint worldview. So I had always believed that my life and the world unfolded according to a meticulous divine blueprint, and that there was a mysterious higher good behind everything that comes to pass. And that was sort of my upbringing and my Christian background. And then in my late 20s, early 30s, as I started losing sleep at night, staying up with my babies, I started listening to these podcast sermons from different preachers. And I think just to have a little bit more adult interaction, a little bit of positivity in the middle of the night. And that's when I came across the podcasts from Woodland Hills. And I encountered a very different picture of God and a very different worldview.
So you'd always been interested then in finding ways to put your faith together with what you experience in the real world. And in the book, you obviously give a little background to your own faith journey up to that point. You'd had your doubts over the years when it came to Christian faith, hadn't you?
I had solidly been a Christian, but I had a difficult time with accepting that God is love if he planned all of the evil and the suffering in the world and some of the hard things that I had been through in my life. And so I had a lot of cognitive dissonance between God and Jesus. Jesus I liked. I liked reading about Jesus and learning about Jesus. That was someone that I wanted to be around. But God, because I believed in the blueprint worldview, was someone that I had more hesitations about. I say, you know, that when I prayed, I could never be certain whether God was snarling or whether God was smiling. So I didn't have the same level of connection there.
I mean, eventually, over time, you sort of worked through some of those theological issues. You got to a point where you were married, happily married to Ian, and life kind of progressed. You obviously had children as well. The story isn't one where the crisis that came into your life then produced a crisis of faith, because you'd thought about the issues of suffering and evil sometime before your own crisis emerged. So what kind of made you start to look into these particular issues in the way that you were exploring them?
Yes, and I'm glad you brought that up, because this is something that is so on my heart, to encourage others to wrestle with their picture of God before a crisis hit. So as I was saying earlier, I was up late at night with these young babies and I was listening to podcasts, and I came across this very different picture of God, this picture of God that was fully rooted in the person of Jesus Christ. And Hebrews 1:3 was a key verse for me at that time, because it was saying that Jesus is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being. And that was so exciting for me, because it was giving me the instruction to begin to view this God that I didn't know if he was snarling or smiling as the exact representation that we get in Jesus, this God who healed the sick and raised the dead and washed the feet of his disciples and gave his life out of love for us. So I began to wrestle with anything that I held in my picture of God that didn't line up with this beautiful God revealed in Jesus. And because I spent a few years doing that, really saying, where do I not see John 10:10 in my picture of God? Where do I not see a God bringing life to the full? And how can I reconcile that with this God revealed in Jesus? Because I had landed fully on a picture of God revealed in Jesus, by the time my son was diagnosed with brain cancer a couple of years later, I had rejected the idea that life unfolds according to a mysterious blueprint of God's design. And I had rather accepted the idea that God is not the only force in the universe that determines what comes to pass, that there's a multiplicity of wills that affect what happens, and that all evil ultimately originates in wills other than God. And that meant that God and I were on the same side as my little boy dealt with brain cancer. We were battling to bring life to the full within the constraints of the world that he created. And it just radically transformed my ability to fall into God's arms without reservation.
We're going to talk about the story, and it is a tragic one that, and I will warn anyone who does get hold of your book, that you're not in for an easy read. I certainly didn't find it easy to read, though very compelling at the same time. And the kind of thing you're going to need to have some tissues nearby for. It's a very emotional, heart-wrenching journey that you go on, as any journey involving the suffering of a loved one is going to be. We'll come to that in just a moment's time. But if you're listening and you'd like to get a little bit more detail on Jessica, don't forget that you can find details on today's website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Look for today's show there, and you'll find details for all the guests featuring on today's programme, as well as, of course, links to past programmes as well that you may be interested in getting hold of. And if you'd like to get in touch about anything you hear on today's show, unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the email address. Look forward to hearing from you that way. Don't forget we've got the social media on Twitter and Facebook as well if you'd like to contact us. Don't forget all of that available from the website, which I've just told you about. So we're talking to Jessica Kelly on today's programme, author of Lord Willing. We're going to be hearing about how she handled the fact of her son's death at the age of 4 years old. Deep stuff, hard stuff on the show today, but well worth your time and attention.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Jessica, it must be, in a sense, painful for you to have to not only write the book, but also to relive this story again and again as you talk to people like me who ask you about it and about the story. Why it makes you want to tell this story before we get into it?
You know, I think for me it was such a gift to have a picture of God as one who was partnering with me to bring life to the full as Henry battled and suffered and died from brain cancer. And it's one of those things that when you receive a gift this great, you just can't keep it to yourself. You know that it can change the life and the faith of others. And so it's something that is a privilege and a joy to be a part of passing that forward, or paying that forward, if you will. And also it's a way that I see God bringing pain to this purpose, or purpose to this pain. So I say in the book that, you know, I don't believe God orchestrated Henry's suffering and death for a purpose, but that our God of creativity and resourcefulness and love meets this pain with purpose as it transpires and as we move forward. And so it's a joy to see purpose infused to this loss.
Tell me about Henry. So obviously children were what you wanted in your life, you and your husband. In many ways, Henry was an answer to prayer in that way. Tell me about, though, how things progressed as you realized something was wrong with your child as things went along.
And you're right. Henry was the realization of my lifelong dream. I had always wanted to be a mom. And so Henry was my first baby, and it was such a joy to be his mom and just the sweetest boy that you would ever meet. But, yeah, I talk about in the book the year leading up to his diagnosis was a year that in a lot of ways was ordinary, but there were compounding issues that made it kind of extraordinary leading up to the diagnosis. So I talk about in January having dealt with a lot of ear infections, and Ian and I giving Henry antibiotics to clear up the ear infections. But we noticed then that he was losing his appetite and that he wouldn't eat. And so he'd start to tremble just a little bit. And we thought that was from low blood sugar. Later, we learned that was probably due to the hydrocephalus from the brain tumor. So he refused the food, and he would have some fluctuating moods, which were probably due to a loss of appetite or ear infections. We couldn't be sure. So he had a lot of sort of vague symptoms, stomach viruses that we thought, well, he needs to get out into the fresh air. He needs to get out of the winter and into spring and into fresh air. And so then these stomach viruses will clear up. But nausea is actually a very common symptom of a brain tumor and throwing up. And so a lot of these things were compounding, and we'd take him to the pediatrician because he wasn't gaining weight, but he was still in the healthy range. And the pediatrician said, you know, everything's coming back normal, so let's just watch him. Let's get to spring. Let's get some ear tubes in his ears to clear up the infections. And so we did all of that. But he continued to get worse and to struggle with his health. And it was in late September of 2012 that we took him back to the pediatrician because now the trembling was more pronounced and he was very fatigued. And I remember the pediatrician walking in the room and seeing him sitting sweetly on the paper there in the office and looking at me like, what do you mean he's trembling? This little boy looks normal and fine and sweet and happy. And I put him down on the ground and I said, honey, step up on the stool. And so he tried to step up on the stool and he was trembling so badly we had to reach out and hold him. And so that's when a lump just formed in my throat and it just stayed there for weeks as we, you know, moved forward. But that's when we got more blood tests. Because the doctor said, you know, maybe this is autoimmune. If it's autoimmune, there could be a cure. Let's get some more blood work. But all of that was negative. And he said, well, you know, maybe Henry has a pinched nerve in his spine, and that's why he's trembling. So he scheduled a spinal MRI later in the month, and he scheduled a follow-up with a neurologist the next week to be safe. But we never made those appointments because by Friday, the symptoms were so intense that we took him to the Children's Hospital emergency room. And that's when we were admitted and we sat in a very small room with a very tired child until about midnight when the pediatric neurosurgeon was paged. And it was a Friday night after midnight. And we learned that the pediatric neurosurgeon is coming to meet personally with us at the hospital. And the nurses say, you know what, we're going to stay here with Henry, and we're going to let you have some private time with the doctor. And so that was a long walk down the hallway from Henry's little waiting room there to meet with the neurosurgeon who had the MRI scans up on the lit board. And he said, guys, all of this is tumor. Goodness. And we need to operate, and we need to get him well.
Wow. And at that point, I can imagine as a parent myself, just that lump that started in your throat becomes the dead weight in your heart of anxiety and horror. How did you respond to that diagnosis?
You know, in that moment, there was so much shock and I was so naive. And so when a surgeon says, this is tumor, we need to operate, we need to get him well. There was a horror that this is very, very bad. There was a little bit of relief that I've seen him getting worse and worse all year with negative blood results and no diagnosis that suits what's going on. And now people understand there's something going on and they're all on board to help. And there was a relief in knowing that the, you know, incredibly talented medical professionals were now focused on, like he said, helping him get well. And so my full expectation was this road is going to be extremely difficult, but we are going to walk it and we are going to get him well and get him home.
Yeah. You went down that road and it was a huge operation, wasn't it? But it didn't ultimately have the kind of hoped for desire that you wanted.
You're right. It was a 6-hour craniotomy that he had just 4 days later. And we were hoping that he would come back to us, the surgeon, and say, we got all of the tumor and it was benign. Because if they told us we got all the tumor, then there's a very good chance we recover, go home, and live life normally. And of course, if it's benign, there's a wonderful chance we go home, we live life normally. And so the prayers from our family, our friends, our expanding group of supporters now through Facebook and social media, growing across the country, was they got it all, it's benign. They got it all, it's benign. That's all we wanted to hear. And 6 hours after the surgery began, we met with the surgeon and we learned that they didn't get it all. They got about 50%. And they had to stop the surgery early because he lost 3 liters of blood, and that was enough to fill his entire body. And it wasn't benign. It was extremely aggressive and malignant.
So what were your options at this point?
At this point, because of his age, he had just turned 4, and the extreme rareness of the tumor and the aggressiveness of this malignant tumor, we had very few options. And even with an aggressive experimental treatment, his chances of surviving were extremely low. And so my husband and I, we went through much prayer, much discussion with medical professionals, and we ultimately decided that the only option that we had peace with was to get him some rehabilitation from the brain surgery, which itself is a traumatic procedure, but to get him some inpatient rehab so that we could take him home as able-bodied as possible with hospice care. And I remember telling his neurosurgeon, this is what we've decided to do. And it was the same man that had met with us that night in the ER. And he said with tears in his eyes, he said, I wish I had a reason to disagree with you guys. And I wish that I could tell you to keep fighting, but I can't. He said, I would want what you're doing if I were in Henry's situation. And he talked about the dignity that we would give him, bringing him home surrounded by his family and his friends in our big bed that he loved. And he said, this, you know, this is what I would want. But even though it was supported by his medical community, it was just gut-wrenching for us.
It's so sad. And, you know, I'm getting, I'm tearing up myself at the thought of it. This obviously was really seeing Henry through to the point where he was going to pass away. So, What did you do with that final time, and what kind of prayers were you able to pray?
We had about 8 weeks with him at home, and we were really blessed by a community that just stepped up and rallied behind him. And so we had local police officers and firefighters come and show him all their big, shiny, loud vehicles. And we had family come from across the country, and it was October in Georgia in the United States, and so it was warm outside, but we said, it's Henry's, this is all about giving Henry as much time, as much love, as rich of an experience as possible. And so we said, we're decorating for Christmas. That was his favorite. We put up a 10-foot Christmas tree. We exchanged gifts. We, you know, we had some intense, beautiful encounters with one another, and we could feel the hands and feet of Christ in such a powerful way. And there was even one church that felt led to come and surround our house and petition, you know, for a miracle. So there were prayers for healing in spite of the fact that we had accepted hospice care. And so we watched him as we were home begin to recover from the brain surgery and begin to gain some of his physical abilities back and his appetite back. And we thought, you know, maybe, is it possible? Maybe he was healed. Maybe, you know, he's getting, he looks better. He looks bigger. The trembling is gone. And in the hospital, he had lost the use of half of his face for a little while. So his smile was lopsided, and his smile at home came back. He gained all these motor functions, this big, bright smile. And we thought, maybe. And then I remember one morning, coming into the living room, and the Christmas tree was on, and the Christmas cartoons were playing, and I had just made coffee, and I remember watching him reach for his sippy cup, and his hand was shaking. And I looked over at my husband, and he said, I see it too. And that was the moment that we knew there was not going to be a miracle. The trembling was back. He was starting to decline again, and we had weeks left with him until he passed away.
I mean, I don't know how I would feel, and this is something that you can't really know until you've experienced it, I'm sure, but that, I don't know how you continue to pray, in a way, what you pray when you're sort of aware that your son is in, you know, terminal decline in that way. And how you accept, in a way, the prayers of those who, you know, in all good faith are praying for a miracle. How do you handle that? What, you know, as a parent who obviously wants to see a miracle happen, but yet it doesn't happen.
Well, for me, up to the point when he started trembling again, I had been praying some of these big prayers, you know, maybe. But I did feel a sense of peace in letting go of those prayers when I saw the trembling come back. And see, in the worldview that I had adopted, I believe that God does the most good possible always working to maximize good and minimize evil within the constraints of the world that he created. And so I believed God was on the side of life to the full. But I also believe that there are times that God doesn't unilaterally get his way. And so I believe that there were times that he could not accomplish what he would want to accomplish for reasons that we can't be aware of. It's so vast and complex in this universe. We can't always know the why answers. But I had this assurance of God's character, and it allowed me to pray, give me strength, give me peace, help me to know how to help Henry. And it allowed me to borrow from the faith of those around me. I think this is why community in faith is so important, because we don't always have to have the measure of faith we think that we need. We can borrow from someone else who seems to be just rocking and rolling in their faith. And we can say, I'm going to borrow from that person. You be strong and you pray, because I don't even know if I can find the words today. And that was a tremendous source of strength for me, was that there were people around me with faith. And I knew that there were people around me praying for a healing when I could no longer do that. And I knew there were people around me praying for peace and for strength to face whatever lay ahead. And so that enabled me to just move forward, yeah, in my faith in an unspeakable time.
And when Henry did finally pass away, what was your feeling, your prayer? Was it simply the end result of what you knew was coming? Did you feel prepared in any way, or was it was there still a kind of a grief, a shock that obviously came with that?
Well, it was in the last several weeks, it was very clear we were heading towards his passing. And the challenge at that time became to how to parent him well into that transition, how to be strong for him. And I remember someone once told me, you know, Jess, if things are too intense to pray, just say the name of Jesus. Just say that over and over, and that'll be enough. And so I remember the moment that he died. I remember at 10:19 p.m. on December 16th, 2012, I remember just saying the name of Jesus over and over when he took his last breath. And I had spent some time ahead of that in prayer, imagining that moment. And this is something that I've talked with people that are facing the imminent death of a loved one about, is if you want to, in that moment, have peace and maybe you have other young children around or, you know, whatever it is, imagine in prayer that moment. Imagine in prayer being filled with peace and being able to release them into the arms of God. And so when I had first imagined letting Henry go, you know, my mind saw myself hysterical. But as I continued to imagine that moment in prayer and to let the Spirit guide me in prayer, I got to a point where I imagined that passing peaceful and myself peaceful. And when it happened, I did feel that peace that I had spent that time in prayer imagining ahead of time.
That for me is almost the definition of trusting. And you've got an amazing story, Jessica. We're going to continue to hear about it on the other side of a short break. Jessica Kelly, my guest in this part of today's program. She's the author of Lord Willing? Wrestling with God's Role in My Child's Death. And we'll talk to Jessica in the next section about the theological outworking of this. What exactly was it about the way she viewed God's suffering and sovereignty that helped her not to blame God, but to see that God was on her side through this tragedy? You're listening to Unbelievable, a New Year's Eve edition, an emotional and heart-wrenching edition of the show, as I'm sure you'll agree, but I hope you can come back in a short moment's time for part two.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's programme. I'm Justin Brierley, and this is the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together every week normally for dialogue and debate, but doing things a bit differently this New Year's Eve. And I hope that you're enjoying the conversations we're having on today's show. A little bit later on, Sarah Foster is going to be joining me. She is someone who's involved in reaching Muslims, and she's going to be talking about some of the challenges involved in that here in London. Sarah, a remarkably bright young woman. I'm really impressed with her when I met her recently, so I thought, let's get her on the show. And she's going to be talking about her work with FANDA and the apologetics work that they do here in the UK. But right now, we're talking to Jessica Kelly, author of Lord Willing. And Jessica's story I came across several years ago, but it was only recently that we were able to invite her for an interview for Premier Christianity magazine. And if you want to read that interview she gave to Sam Hales in the December edition, I'll make sure there's a link to it from today's episode of the show. Well worth a read. And, well, if you enjoy it, go ahead and get the book as well, Lord willing, that she's written. But if you want the article, premierchristianity.com is the place to go. But equally, find it from the Unbelievable website from today's episode, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. So we heard in that first section there, Jessica, you describing obviously what was an emotionally draining, horrendous time in many ways, but one in which you still learned to trust Henry into the hands of God in a remarkable way, really. And in many ways, you know, this is often the point, the death of a child in particular, which seems so unjust in the world. I mean, it's one thing to lose loved ones when they sort of live out their years, but to lose a child is possibly the worst kind of loss that someone can experience. And a completely innocent child as well. It feels so wrong, doesn't it? And one can understand why so many people, that would become a major barrier to their believing in a loving, good God. Just reiterate again why, for you, the crisis in your life wasn't compounded, as it were, by a crisis of faith.
Oh, because I had received such a gift from a Christian leader who stood in the pulpit and said, God is on the side of life to the full. That John 10:10 says an enemy comes to steal, kill, and destroy. And Jesus, excuse me, who comes to bring life to the full, is the perfect representation of God's heart. And so to the degree that we see life to the full, that we see children being happy and flourishing, and we see good in the world, we see the heart of God reflected. And to the degree that we see suffering and pain and death, we see the will of God being thwarted. And the gift that was given to me, that challenge, because it didn't match up with the picture of God that I had grown up with, spurred me to wrestle with my picture of God. And by wrestling, my faith was better equipped for the pain that came down the road.
You couldn't buy the view of God then that said, even though this looks awful on the surface, God has preordained this situation, because in some way, perhaps in ways you won't recognize, it will ultimately glorify him. You couldn't get with the idea that God himself would somehow be orchestrating these circumstances and this pain that you were experiencing.
I think when you watch the degree of suffering that an innocent child goes through, it brings that view into serious questioning. Because if Henry had died quickly, painlessly into the arms of God, I could almost understand saying, you know, God has a plan for this. But when you watch your child suffer to the degree to which he suffered, and you think, would less pain have been less effective for a God who uses, you know, pain and evil to glorify himself? Did it have to be this degree of suffering for him to be glorified? I think that is one of the first questions that we start to wrestle with. Does this depth and complexity of pain really serve a God, or is this unnecessary and completely incompatible with a God of love?
The view that you have effectively seen this through, this warfare view, holds that there is, if you like, a kind of a cosmic spiritual battle raging, as well as the physical battles we see in life. And so in that sense, although I'm sure you don't fully comprehend it, you see that the pain and the death and so on that Henry experienced was not God's, something to lay at God's door. It's this, the negative side of this spiritual battle. It's the forces of evil that we hear of in Scripture.
Well, I think when we see Jesus in the Gospels coming against sickness and disease and disability and death, we see Jesus healing and or rebuking these things. We see in those instances Jesus revealing to us the heart of the Father. And to the degree that we see then sickness, evil, disability, and death, I think we see the will of God being thwarted. And the beautiful reality of that is that it brings our heart and our mind into alignment. Because if we're told to believe that God is love, and we're told to trust this God and follow this God, and then we see evil and radical suffering, and we're told, no, God's orchestrating that, he's planned that, that's part of his will and his purposes, then we struggle to reconcile in our heart and in our mind, is this God trustworthy? Are his arms safe? But when we take John 10:10 literally, and we say Jesus comes to bring life to the full, an enemy comes to steal, kill, and destroy, then we can reconcile our heart and mind, and it allows us to trust God's arms even when the worst transpires.
I mean, those who would disagree, I mean, I'm sure very much sympathize with what you've been through, Jessica, but still disagree with your theological takeaway from it, we might be tempted to say the problem is this view sort of means that God isn't in control. You know, things kind of happen outside of God's control. You know, that's a problem for many people with their view of God. It almost undermines a key characteristic of God's omnipotence in that sense. What's your response to that?
Yeah, well, the word that I hear a lot is sovereignty. Are you saying God's not sovereign? And I think what happens is that some start with an assumption that God meticulously controls everything. And then they're left to wonder, well, how does this sovereign God love? But I think a better question when we start with a picture of God fully revealed in Jesus is, how does a God of perfect love express his sovereignty? How does he use his power? And I think that the problem with the definition of sovereignty that I mentioned of meticulous control is that it doesn't allow for the possibility of love. But thankfully, that's not the only definition of sovereignty. Because if we look at the mightiest kings in history, kings that are sovereign over their kingdoms, they didn't have meticulous control over every detail that transpired, because meticulous control is not necessary for effective leadership. It doesn't require wisdom or creativity, just brute power. And so I think when we look to Scripture and we look at the most biblically accurate view of God's sovereignty, his ruling authority, it's, in my opinion, understood in that God uses his power. It's manifested through creative and wise and Calvary-like love. Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 1 that the cross is the wisdom and the power of God. So in other words, when God puts on display his omnipotent power, his infinite wisdom, it looks like God getting himself crucified at the hands of his enemies out of love for his enemies. But you're right, this is the exact opposite of the kind of controlling power that the world, and unfortunately much of the church, has always assigned to God or to gods.
Of all the kind of stuff that's out there, Jessica, which deals with the theological issues here, I think your book is perhaps one of the most helpful in terms of framing it within, obviously, a very real life context where you've had to work that, you know, if you like, theoretical theology through in a very practical way. And thank you for the way you've written the book. This will, I think, be a great comfort to many people who've gone through very similar issues, but perhaps haven't had the chance to think it through in the way that you had the opportunity to. And thank you very much for coming on the program today. Thank you.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
It's been great to have you on. Just a reminder, Jessica is the author of Lord Willing, Wrestling with God's Role in My Child's Death. Herald Press is printed by. I'll make sure there are links to it from today's episode. And I would do wish you and the family a very happy new year in the year to come, Jessica.
Thank you so much.
Well, coming up next, we're going to be checking in with Sarah Foster. Sarah is someone who's been involved in reaching out to Muslims in the UK. Sometimes controversial work, and I'll be talking about that with her in the course of today's programme, particularly in regards to the work she's done within the Black and African Caribbean community, where many young men are turning to Islam from Christianity. And we'll be finding out what Sarah is doing and what her team at Fanda are doing in response.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, joining me now on today's special edition of Unbelievable is Sarah Foster, who's part of the coordination of the youth training for Fander Centre for Apologetics. And I met Sarah a few weeks ago and thought I must have her on the show because she's got an interesting story herself. And she does some really interesting work with young people in an area that I think, frankly, is quite underserved and under-resourced in the UK church. Sarah, welcome along to Unbelievable.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, you're here just for a one-to-one. I haven't put you in debate with anyone on this occasion, though. Who knows what the future could hold? Because you've kind of got into the whole area of apologetics and debate. Now, you know, frankly, there's not that many women overall involved in apologetics, and it's something I'm hoping to see change over the coming years. And I don't know whether that's just because apologetics tends to, I don't know, appeal to a man kind of brain over a female brain. But what attracted you in particular to apologetics, would you say?
I think just a passionate belief in the gospel. When I first got interacted with Muslims and found out what the Quran said and started reading the Quran and found out what it said about Jesus, that he didn't die, that he's not the Son of God, that he's not God, I'm like, well, this is not my Jesus. And somebody needs to tell them. So it was just basically trying to communicate the gospel to Muslims, and then you start to deal with the different arguments that they have and really trying to defend the faith, but at the same time ask questions about, okay, where did you get this information from? Where did this Quran come from? How can you trust it? Because we as Christians have to ask the same about our Bible. So that's really...
that's where it came from.
Yeah.
Take us back to your childhood, because you grew up in a Christian family.
Yeah.
Were you challenged kind of early on in any way by some of these questions that you obviously have gone on to think about quite a lot?
Yes, I grew up in a Christian family, went to a Christian school from about, I don't know, 3 to 7. Went to a mainstream school at the age of 7 and was immediately confronted with people who were not Christians and had a different worldview to I did. So it caused me to think and thought, maybe if I was born in a different country, I could have been a Hindu, I could have been a Buddhist, I could have been an atheist, I could have been a Muslim. And so I started, I think in my early to late teens, started looking at, well, where did Jesus come from? Where did this story come from? Is he a real person? Where did we get the Bible from? Is there any evidence to Christianity at all? Is it just based on faith? And I was surprised to see that, yes, there is evidence. And Jesus is a real person. Many people spoke about him. We have lots of documentation. The Gospels are, in fact, our earliest written documents with regard to the life of Jesus. And so that really gave me some a solid foundation for believing that there was something in Christianity. And then at the same time, God blessed me and my friends with an amazing man who sat us down and discipled us, allowed us to ask difficult questions, took us very patiently through the Bible and said, look here, you know, have you read this? You know, put this together, and just really opened up the Bible to us in a way we hadn't seen before, and grounded us in our faith, took us out on evangelism. We ate in his house. It was really a 7-day-a-week discipleship. I owe a lot to
I'm sure
man.
Yeah, I'm sure that was worth its weight in gold.
It's
interesting though to hear that you were in that sense had so many questions and kind of in a sense quite skeptical from a young age. Is that just who you are? Was that prompted by anything?
I think naturally I'm a skeptical person, but I think it's normal to, in a society that has the overtones of a Christian society or has a history of Christianity, it can be normal to grow up in church, go through the motions, progress through the Sunday school classes, to even become youth leaders, worship leaders, but not really at any time be challenged about why you believe what you believe. Not really being challenged at how do you articulate your beliefs? What if somebody comes with this argument against you? And as we're seeing with Fander, the Muslim challenge is
that particularly a challenge in the Black Christian community, would you say? Because I have heard other friends who go to, you know, predominantly Black churches who've said that they've seen quite a lot of young Christian Black men who have been swayed or even converted to Islam in recent years. What's going on there, would you say?
Well, it is a problem. I think more and more people are asking, well, is Christianity a white man's religion? And we know, looking at history, we see Christianity from the first century in Africa. We see Christianity from the first century in Asia. There is a wealth, a strong history of Christianity in these parts of the world, but sometimes we're just presented with a very Eurocentric view. Mm. So some people don't feel like they have... they feel that Christianity has been enforced upon them through the transatlantic slave trade, and it's not really their religion. They need to go back to what was there before, which is quite sad. And with regard to Islam, when I first started going to Speaker's Corner, I would be challenged practically every week. How can you be black and be a Christian? Don't you know what they did to your ancestors? And then there was this argument that Islam came to stop slavery, which was just absolutely ridiculous. And so if we don't know our history, if we don't know a very rounded view of Christianity, the history of Christianity, in terms of its position in Africa and in Asia, it's easy to be swayed by these arguments. We're also getting a lot of people converting to... Black Hebrew Israelites. We see that happening a lot. The Kemetic religion, some early African spirituality.
Is this again the idea of people being told then that Christianity is, sort of a colonial white man's kind of religion, and people who are going to those other types of points of view believe they're kind of engaging with something that's older and more authentic to their cultural background, sort of thing?
Yeah, and it's about identity. I mean, where do we go back to? Is it that we only became Christians, and I'm saying we as in the black community only became Christians because of the slave master? Is there something more authentic than that? Is there something that goes back to our own history? Now, there's this argument is false on a number of reasons, because just because something may have had a negative history, if there is truth in it, if people who were perpetuating it were not perpetuating it properly, if people who were calling themselves Christians weren't actually following Christ, then it doesn't matter whether it was started or brought to you by a white person or an Asian person or a black person. If it's true, it's true. Mm. But there does seem to be a need to be able to connect with it. And the wonderful thing about the gospel is that color is not an issue in the Bible. We don't see people being called black or being called white or being called brown. We see people coming from Kush. We see people coming from Syria. We see people being named or identified by their geographical or their ethnic heritage as opposed to their color. When it comes to Jesus Christ, our example, we don't have a description to go by. He's of no wonderful appearance that anyone should behold him. He's marred. If we had a description of Jesus, what he looks like, we would worship that.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. Just coming back to your story, did you find growing up in church in your context that some of your friends as you reach, teenage years and things, were starting to be approached by people who were kind of talking about Islam and those kinds of types of different points of view in that way?
Yeah, different points of view, definitely some friends and family. And these are things that we would discuss and come to conclusions on. There's lots of videos on YouTube. There's lots of different information on the internet. So it's something that we had to kind of work our way through.
And how did your faith develop through university? I think you went to study law, didn't you?
Yeah, I went to study law, wanted to serve the persecuted church. That was the aim, and I came out doing not that and practicing law, but in a different area. But at that time, God had really given me a passion for Muslims. Started reading the Quran, and as I said before, finding out that it was a different Jesus than portrayed in the Jesus of history, the biblical Jesus. And for me, that was a major problem. And it's not a Muslim's fault; they don't know it's in their Quran, so someone has to tell them. So that's what I want to do.
What got you involved with Jay Smith and Beth Grove and the group who have been doing those quite high intensity debates down at Hyde Park at Speaker's Corner?
Well, God really put this passion in my heart. I can't think of another time in my life where I had such a passion that I was eating up anything I could find on the internet to do with Christian-Muslim debates. And then I came across some training run by Intias Khan of London City Mission, who would do Christian Muslim dialogue. So I got involved with that group. Through that group, I got involved with a different group. And through that group, I met Beth Grove. And she took me under her wing and has really been a wonderful sister in Christ to me. And as the whole team, Jay and Beth and the other members, have really taught me, and now I'm engaging.
Do you kind of get involved in the cut and thrust of the debates yourself down there?
Oh yes, it's hard not to. I think the first couple of times I went down there, I was like, I'm not going to say anything. But then they start saying something about Jesus, and you're like, that's not true. He is God, and so it's hard not to get involved.
Yeah, sure. I mean, with the role you now have with Founder Centre for Apologetics, which of course Jay and Beth have been involved in setting up and running. You're particularly tasked with developing resources for youth.
Yes.
Now, most church youth groups, Sunday schools and so on, that I know are very unlikely to be talking to their young people about Islam.
Yes.
Why do you think they should be?
Well, just in the last week, I have met three new Muslim contacts. One of them runs an Islamic school on the weekends and is looking to run the school full time. The other two went to an Islamic school from 11 years old until they left at 16. We have a massively growing Islamic population, which is not a bad thing. Just looking at some of the figures, we see that there is a 33%, and the Muslim population, their age profile is much younger than the national average. And so between 0 and 15, the Muslim population is at 33%, whereas it's 19% for the rest of the national average. We have seen an 80.4% increase of Muslims in the age of 0 to 5 in the last 2 years. That's 80.5, not 1.8, wow, it's 80.5. And so this is not a bad thing. This is not to scare anyone, but it presents us with an opportunity to reach out to our Muslim friends. Now, as I said, I've met people who've gone to Islamic schools, and there is a number of Islamic schools that teach children every day after school, on the weekends, about Islam. And inherent in Islam are arguments against Christianity. Inherent in the Quran, there's arguments that Jesus didn't die, that he cannot be God. He's not the son of God. Mm. How can God have a son when he's had no consort? He doesn't have a wife. And so our young people, our youth, our children are being engaged at this level, even from the age of five, because the Muslim schools run from the age of five all the way up to 18. And so I've had the experience of a boy in my own youth group who only has Muslim friends at his school. And during one of the Sunday school sessions, he said, well, Jesus isn't God. And it just took me aback.
Right.
And the reason he said that is because his Muslim friends are engaging him in conversation about these very important theological issues. Obviously, we had to go through why the reasons why Jesus is God, but we're going to see that more and more as the population of Muslims increase in this country. We're going to see more and more that our children are challenged about their faith. Why do they believe it?
Sure.
And we have to train up our children in the way they should go, as the Bible says in Proverbs 22. We have to prepare them to articulate their faith. Why do they believe it? And also help Muslims to ask questions about why they believe what they believe. It can be a two-way thing.
Yeah. I mean, frankly, there are many adults out there who could do with that kind of training as well. But for you, the focus is obviously on helping young people to articulate their faith and to have an answer for a Muslim who may be pressing them and criticising
Christianity. 1 Peter 3:15.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Which is very encouraging. But at the same time, I can imagine, sort of for the reasons that you've been very careful in the way you've talked about the growth of Islam, churches, I think, are worried, frankly, that they don't want to appear Islamophobic. They don't want to appear to be bashing or criticising Muslims, per se.
Yeah.
So how do we steer that line?
Yeah, it's interesting because one of the people who I mentioned who was running an Islamic school, I met him at Speaker's Corner last Sunday, and he said, well, doesn't this seem a bit confrontational? And I said, well, we're just trying to seek truth. And I said to him, inherent in Islam is attacks against Christianity, and they're very serious attacks. They go to the foundation of our faith. We know in 2 Corinthians it says, if Christ has not been raised from the dead, our faith is futile, we're still in our sins. And the Quran says Christ never died. And so these are very serious and fundamental issues that we need to discuss. And so in a way we discuss it, it seems like we're going against Islam, but it's just really trying to find truth on these foundational issues. And at the end of the day, isn't it about salvation? Don't we want our Muslim friend to know the truth, the gift of God through Christ, that his or her sins can be forgiven, mm-hmm. and that they can be back in relationship with God? Just like my Muslim friends want me to know that if I worship Jesus, I'm committing shirk, I'm going to go to hellfire. Mm-hmm. So if we both want the best for each other, we're going to speak, and we're going to try and identify how did God reveal himself? What does he require of us? What has he given in terms of revelation? These are very, very important questions, and we shouldn't shy away from them. In fact, we're commanded to go.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with my guest, Sarah Foster, joining me in this section of Unbelievable. She's coordinating the youth training for the Fanda Centre for Apologetics, particularly reaching out to Muslims. And she's going to continue to talk about what they're developing in terms of their youth programme. In a short moment's time, come back again for the final part of Unbelievable very shortly.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories.
Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
Have you heard the one about the three comedians who walked into a church? In our New Year edition, meet Milton Jones, Sally Phillips and Paul Carenza as they have a conversation on putting together their faith with careers in TV and radio comedy. Plus, we talk to the Reverend Richard Coles, former 80s pop star, now one of the UK's most famous vicars. Sam Hales attends a New Age fair and tells you what happened. All that plus much more.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
Welcome back to our New Year's Eve edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, part of Faith Explored, every week here on Premier Christian Radio. And I do hope you'll come back during 2017 for the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate every week. Admittedly, not doing that today because I've had two Christian guests joining me on the programme today. Again, if you want to listen back to today's show, a little bit different to usual, extended interviews rather than a dialogue or debate on today's programme, you can listen back at the show page, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can find links there to the podcast, features, articles, blogs, and much more besides. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. We'll be hearing some of your feedback to editions of the programme going back a few weeks towards the end of today's show, so stick around for that. Between 4 and 5 this afternoon on The Profile, Dr. Jack Graham is the pastor of Prestonwood Baptist Church. He's going to be talking to Sam Hales about his life and ministry. It's one of the largest churches in America, and he's got a new book on angels out. So that's our subject on The Profile between 4 and 5 this afternoon. If you're coming back for Unbelievable next week on the show, then you're going to hear a really fun discussion. I really enjoyed having it between two people, Joe and Tom. We're calling it My Friend, the Atheist Churchgoer, because Joe, a Christian, takes his atheist friend Tom along to church with him every week. Joe's written an article about that in the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine. I got to sit down with both of them to talk about that. The effect it has on Joe as a Christian of having an atheist next to him as he worships in church each Sunday, and what Tom makes of it all. Whether it has changed his mind in any way about the truth of Christianity. So look out for that at the same time next week.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, before we get to some of your feedback, I'm just going to continue my conversation, finish up my conversation with my guest in this hour of the programme, Sarah Foster. And Sarah, you were describing your own journey of faith and some of the questions that you dealt with, and the way that you've felt called most recently to start to develop youth programs,
yeah.
which help young people to engage with Islam. Something you've particularly seen in your own community, the fact that lots of young people are being told, you know, and if you like, the criticisms of Christianity, objections to Christianity by Muslims and so on. And you believe there are good answers, obviously, to all of that. So what kind of types of resources are you actually trying to develop, practically speaking, for young people of different ages when it comes to addressing these kinds of issues?
Yeah, so our team is developing a 12-week or 12-session course which will answer some of the questions that our kids will get, primarily, well, to you, your religion, to me, mine. What's the whole point of talking about it? Can't we just agree? Is there objective truth, basically? Yeah, yeah. Is it worth discussing these salvation issues? Questions like, you know, in the Quran, it talks about, say not three, God is one. Why do we talk about the Trinity? Why do we believe in the Trinity? How do we articulate it to our Muslim friend? We ask questions like, you know, did Jesus actually die on the cross, and what the evidence is for that?
Sure.
Who is Jesus in history? So there's a number of there's actually 12 sessions that we go through, and these will be the questions that our young people will get from Muslims. They're sourced in the Quran, they're sourced in Islamic literature, and they're just standard questions.
These are debates we've had on Unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know, quite a high level, frankly,
over
the years. How do you kind of deliver that for obviously a much younger audience?
We're going to be using lots of different teaching methods, like face-to-face, infographics. We'll be using apps. We'll have a website. We will be using Bible helps and little cheat sheets, mind maps, whatever we can do, or social media platforms. Really, we just want to make... let our young people know that there are answers to these questions. And if they don't know the answer, we want to be able to point them in where they can get the answer. We want to become a resource for them, essentially. Because these questions, these big topics, as you said, are not just applicable to Muslims. When people are questioning your ideology, whether they're atheists, whether they're Kemetic, whether they're Buddhist, we need to explain why we believe in the Trinity, why we believe Jesus is God, why we believe there is only one way.
In that sense, it's a primer for your Christian orthodoxy generally,
yes.
I suppose, being able to answer
yes.
another's objections. That's what I found with Unbelievable, certainly, is the more that you kind of develop a case for Christianity, the more you're kind of able to engage with all kinds of different worldviews.
I've had Muslims as young as 9 ask me or tell me that Jesus is not God because he ate food, which is a reason given in the Quran.
Right.
And I'm just thinking, I was trying to think back what I was doing at the age of 9 in Sunday school. And I think I was colouring in. I wasn't thinking about these.
So for you, the church is well behind where most Muslims are
when it comes
to kind of putting the faith across to their children.
Yeah.
We need to up our game, basically.
We have a duty to prepare the next generation. And they're not even the next generation, because they're being faced with these attacks right now. And as I said, I met these two women who went to Islamic school from 11 to 16. Every single day they had Islamic classes. And it's normal for children going to Islamic school to have some sort of religious teaching every single day. And as I said, the polemics against Christianity are there in it.
It's really interesting. Obviously, this is all in development at this stage.
Yeah.
And so I'm sure we'll hear more about it in due course. To some extent, you know, the fact is, as you say, the population growth of Islam itself kind of, in a sense, is a factor in all of this. Christianity, let's be honest, lots of parts of the church is in decline. I mean, lots of people talk about the fact that maybe Islam will one day outstrip Christianity in the UK. I mean, do you think that's true? What do you think is the answer to that, if that is true?
Well, we know that Islam is growing by birth rate and not conversion. They simply have more children than we do. Most of them would be nominal Muslims, so we're not talking about those who would go to mosque every day, observe the dietary requirements, just as we have nominal Christians who don't go to church every week or read their Bibles. But there is an ideology that comes with it. There is a certain identity that comes with it that we need to be prepared for. And it's not a bad thing being a minority. It's in persecution where the church grows the most. We see the example in Iran. We see the example in China. Even in North Korea, there's a massive movement of Christians underground, and that thankfully South Korea are really welcoming. So we shouldn't look on this as, you know, desperate times or despairing times, we should see this as an opportunity to get on board with what God is doing and to really become a part of sharing and bringing the gospel to Muslims. It's really a joy. And the great thing about working with Muslims is that they get you to go back into your Bible and understand why you believe what you believe. They get you to go back and look at Jesus and really depend on him as the foundation of your faith. Mm. Everything is there. It's not like we don't have answers. Mm. It's just how do we prepare our young people, ourselves, to present Jesus to Muslims.
And just as we conclude, I mean, last time I had Jay and Beth on this program over the summer, there was a lot of appreciation for that, but also some pushback, not just from non-Christians, but from Christians as well, who felt like their approach is too strong, too divisive, too maybe even, you know, verges on Islamophobia or something. Now, just for the record, tell me why, as far as you're concerned, what you're doing is nothing like Islamophobia.
Well, Islamophobia means you're scared of Islam. We're not scared of Islam. We don't like the ideology because it pits itself against the knowledge of Christ. So we love Muslims, not so keen on Islam. So as long as you separate the two, there should not really be an issue. And we're talking about ideologies just the same way Muslims look at our ideology and are disgusted that we would worship a man, they think, and make a man God, which is not what we've done at all. God came down and put on human flesh. Just as they're disgusted with that, are we going to call that Christianophobia? We're not going to do that, are we? We're going to engage with the ideas and we're going to love our Muslim friends while we do it. And to love someone is to tell them the truth, to tell them, look, God has revealed to us that Jesus is the only way to salvation, and this is through his sacrifice on the cross. And if I don't tell my Muslim friend that, am I really loving to them? If my Muslim friend doesn't tell me that they think I've committed shirk and I'm going to hellfire because I worship Jesus, then they're not being loving to me. In fact, Muslims respect you because they know what Christians believe. They think they know what Christians believe. They have an idea, and if we pretend that we don't believe that, and if we're not telling them, they'll know.
Okay. Yeah. It's been fascinating talking to you, Sarah. All the best as you roll out this youth program across the coming year. If you want to follow FANDA, that's FANDA Centre for Apologetics, go to fanda.uk. It's funny spelling. So just watch out for that. It's PFANDER, fanda.uk. You can also email for more info as well, info@fanda.uk. And Sarah, did you want to add one more thing?
Yeah, just one more thing. So we are available to do talks and trainings for youth groups and Sunday schools and even mission trips and summer camps. So if you do want to get in touch with us, and Justin's just given you the email, info@fanda.uk, and we'll try and arrange something with you.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Have a very blessed 2017 and all the best for the coming year.
Thank you.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, do get in touch if you're interested in dropping me a line about anything you've heard on today's programme. As usual, the email address, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Or feel free to send me your thoughts via social media. Follow us on Twitter @UnbelievableJB or on Facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. And I like to post up stuff that we regularly put out either via the magazine website or from Unbelievable itself on all of those ways. So do follow on if you're interested in finding out more about the stuff that I'm interested in. We had a Secret Santa here at Premier Towers in the run-up to Christmas. Everyone, you know, buys someone else in the office something that they don't know who the person in question is getting them it. Well, I opened mine in the run-up to Christmas. And, well, if you follow Unbelievable, you may be aware that I'm currently working on a book due out in 2017, looking at sort of over a decade's worth of conversations between Christians and non-Christians and what I've drawn from that in terms of my own case for Christianity. Well, my esteemed colleague, Jamie Cutteridge, the editor of Premier Youth and Children's Work magazine, has rather scooped me when it comes to writing an apologetics book, because my Secret Santa present was a special edition of his book, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Apologetics But Were Too Bored to Ask, with four words, including Joyce Meyer saying, I wish I'd written this, Cutteridge is a visionary, and Premier Christianity apparently saying, sure to set about, fresh revival, total game changer. And then if you actually
go inside. The content is simply stunning, what Jamie has put together here, apparently in an afternoon when he was a bit bored. He's even included in the book a QR code for the audiobook version of it. So shall we just listen to a little bit of this?
Welcome to Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Apologetics But Were Too Bored to Ask, an audiobook by Jamie Cutteridge. Chapter 1. Boring. Apologetics.
And it carries on like that for quite a while until...
I thank you.
So, yeah, I see this being snapped up by apologetics fans everywhere very quickly, personally. Yes, Jamie Cutteridge isn't convinced of the value of apologetics. I've got a lot of work to do with Jamie, and who knows whether when my book does eventually appear, it will change his mind at all. I suspect probably not. Yes, very, very fun. Very good book that Jamie put together for his Secret Santa present to me. Thank you, Jamie, who described himself on the back cover as Professor Jamie Cutteridge, a world-renowned apologist. He has written hundreds of books, including Apologetics, Who Cares? Yes. Well, Jamie, if you're listening, I do appreciate the effort you've put into that. It was quite the most remarkable Secret Santa present I've ever received in my 14 years or more of being here at Premier Christian Radio. Anyway, if you're interested in how my book's going, it's getting there. It's getting there. I'm approaching the deadline very shortly for submitting it to the publishers. So if you're the praying type, do continue to pray. I'm hoping that it will really kind of, I suppose, reflect and draw upon and distill, you know, the 11 years now that the program's been going. And really, you know, I'm here as the moderator week in, week out most times. This really is me putting myself in the apologist role and saying, OK, having heard so many arguments both ways, here's where I think the rubber really hits the road when it comes to the core of Christianity. So anyway, look out for that in 2017. And as I mentioned last week, if you've got ideas for shows you'd like to hear in 2017, be very interested to hear from you. Do get in touch. And it may be a topic, it may be an individual. Let me know and I'll see what I can do about it. I try to incorporate as many of them as possible. And who knows, your desired topic or guest might be able to feature in the coming year. Thanks to everyone who has faithfully been downloading, listening to the show all around the world, or listening on a Saturday afternoon to the broadcast. The show really has become what it is because you listen and because I'm able to interact with so many interesting people across the faith spectrum. So my sincere thanks, and I'm looking forward to all the new listeners we'll pick up in 2017 as well. You can find us, of course, on the website. You can find us on iTunes, RSS feed, and much more besides. Lots of different ways to listen to Unbelievable. Okay, I've got some of your emails to read out. Quite a few that have come in regard to the Doug Axe and Keith Fox debate. That was a few weeks ago now, but they were talking about whether design in nature is undeniable. Doug Axe is a molecular biologist. He believes his research has shown that the nature of the proteins, the folding nature of them, the things they can do cannot have arisen by a sort of piecemeal neo-Darwinian process. Keith Fox was our theistic evolutionist arguing against the intelligent design conclusions of Doug Axe. Andrew in Portland, Oregon says, I've been listening to the program for a year or so now. This is my first time writing in. I practice medicine as a living. Found the recent debates between Doug and Keith and Luke and Fuzz very interesting. I'm familiar with these arguments on both sides and over the years have watched atheist professors struggle their way around complexity and professors of faith struggle their way around what appear to be design flaws. Ultimately, I think the strength of Keith and Luke's position lies in theology and not in the science, where they may suppose. The theistic evolutionist presents their arguments as an explanation to design errors. The idea of a perfect designer designing imperfect creation seems incompatible to them. However, I don't see how invoking a perfect creator who upholds the laws of nature instead of specially tinkering ultimately creates imperfect creatures is any more satisfying. It would seem that if they argue that a perfect creator shouldn't create, imperfect creatures, then the argument would follow that a perfect creator shouldn't create laws of nature that evolve imperfect creatures. Couldn't an all-powerful God equally uphold perfect laws of nature that only perfectly evolve perfect creatures? Instead, I think their strength lies in something that Keith touched on, which is the idea that a God who doesn't tinker and instead upholds laws of nature which themselves allow for the evolution of the complexity of life presents a larger view of God. It shares much with the strengths of the open theism view presented by Greg Boyd, in that it claims that the God who can do all of what we've seen without having to be a micromanaging director is a greater God than the one imagined in special creation. When we see people accomplish great things with less controlling natures, we find their success to be all the greater. Shouldn't we view God in the same light? If then theistic evolution gives us a greater conceivable being, then theologically it becomes the superior argument to special design. This isn't to say that science isn't important. It vitally is. I just think their greatest strength was a little underplayed. Thank you, Andrew, in Oregon, and thanks for emailing in for the first time. Jeff in Canada wanted to say a couple of questions that jumped out at me. How does the fall of man play into some of the perceived imperfections argued against God's perfect design? Couldn't this explain some of the unexplainable imperfections or the spiritual realm and its influence on the physical? This is if both guests believe in man's fall from perfection and the influence of the spirit world. It seems at times difficult to sufficiently defend scientific arguments as they relate to the Christian faith when a huge proponent of what we believe and observe in the natural is affected by the spiritual. So for Christians who differ in opinions between the above views, shouldn't the spiritual and the fall be a factor that should be considered? Yes, I think that would be the direction that most people who take a creationist or intelligent design view of things would go when it comes to the fact there are lots of imperfections in nature. They'd say those are a result of the fall, but they don't, as it were, eliminate the fact that you can see design there as well. Certainly, I'm sure there are other views out there as well, as there always are on these things. Michael Brady says, Doug Axe's common science, as a play on the term common sense, betrays a willful ignorance of the role of the scientific method, which is applied precisely in attempt to counteract the many flaws in our cognitive apparatus. Critical thinking is an unnatural act, calling for rigorous discipline and deliberate effort. Intuitions resulting from the way our embodied minds perceive the world gave us our spiritual sensibilities. We invented spirits, gods, and then God as an explanation for those feelings, intuitions, and perceptions. Thus, it remains far easier to demonstrate how nature created the God-shaped whole than it is to explain how a deity might inscribe his will on our hearts and upon strands of our deoxyribonucleic acid. The idea that a child's exploration of the world constitutes science falls short, as such observations result in a physics toolkit somewhere between those of Aristotle and Newton in sophistication at most, and which can go no further without ignoring our gut feelings. Even some of Newton's physics are counterintuitive, while general relativity and quantum mechanics are utterly so. Dr. Axe's go with your gut, trust your feelings mentality serves only to lower the bar in support of an argument from ignorance. Let's move on from talking about Doug Axe and Keith Fox to Tom Wright. He joined me for two special programs, one a Q&A with lots of listeners getting involved and asking him various questions about scripture, and also a debate on the atonement in light of his new book, The Day the Revolution Began. That was with Tom Schreiner from Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. And that's provoked all kinds of emails, and many of which I haven't had time to get to, so I'm going to revisit some of them now, some of the ones I couldn't bring a while ago when we were hearing your feedback to that. Colin Mundy, for instance, says, it was interesting to hear Tom Wright talk about the default religion in America being Gnosticism. It seems to be spreading to the church over here. By here you mean the UK, I assume, with many self-help books and a focus on mind and psychology. Are we becoming self-centered instead of Christ-centered? Perhaps this could be a good topic for a future show. Thank you very much, Colin. This one from Roger Harper, who is ordained in the Church of England, and it's one I've been holding on to for a little while because it's a bit of a longer email, but he wanted to specifically respond to Tom Wright's view on the atonement. So here's Roger Harper's email. It was good to listen to the two Toms talk about atonement. Thanks for inviting comments. This email is longer than you probably convey normally. But as Tom Wright said, it's hard to give a short answer or even a short comment. On Sunday evening, I was talking about atonement with assorted clergy in Derby who do a beer and theology session once a month. I was presenting a view that the central problem with sin is the wounds we inflict on each other. God deals with this by a covering of blood, like like a scab covering a wound to enable healing and prevent festering. I'd be interested to know your take and that of others on this view. How helpful is it? How much has it been expounded before? The view comes from Leviticus 16, the instructions for the annual dealing with sin, Yom Kippur. It was good to hear both Toms bring out the importance of the Old Testament background. Kippur means simply and literally covering. The blood makes a covering, verse 27. Kippur was spread over the inside and outside of Noah's Ark to prevent it leaking. There, Kippur is actually translated pitch, a covering which protects, preserves and makes good. When Wycliffe was translating into English, he didn't want to translate Kippur as covering, not entirely sure why not, so he invented a new word, at-one-ment, atonement. For years, we have thought that the blood makes atonement, whereas the Hebrew is more literally that the blood is for covering. Where do we see blood covering? Blood is released by a wound and then covers the wound to form a scab. This covering of blood enables healing, repair, reconstruction to take place under the covering. The covering of blood stops infection from entering the wound and hindering healing, similar to the pitch covering stopping the waters of chaos from seeping into and damaging the ark. Is this the fundamental understanding of what's happening to the sins of the people? Their wounds, especially the wounds they've inflicted on others, are covered by God-given blood so that healing and repair can happen without the world, the flesh and the devil hindering the process of healing. A further insight from the Hebrew, which I've not fully thought through, is that the covering happens in the Holy of Holies, the blood being placed specifically on the top of the covenant box. We are used to this top as the mercy seat. The Hebrew word is kaporet, the same KPR root as Kippur. The NRSV rightly notes that the Hebrew is literally the cover. The blood covering is placed on the cover. Does the blood renew the cover annually? Is this like a damaged scab being renewed with more blood covering the parts which have become exposed? All these implications of covering as how God deals with sin, the primary focus is on what the blood covers rather than on the relationship between humankind and God. The primary problem with sin is that humans wound each other. This damage provokes God to anger, as any parent is angry against someone hurting their child. The anger means that there has to be a distance between God and the wounder. But the rift with God is not dealt with directly, even by an intermediary, leaving the wounds untouched. The rift with God is dealt with by the blood, which covers and heals the wounds. Once the wounds are on the way to being healed, God's anger can pass and the relationship with him is restored. On the cross, Jesus was pouring out his blood to cover all the wounds inflicted by humanity, thereby bringing healing, repair to those wounds. By his stripes, we are healed. The blood which oozes from cuts all over Jesus' body covers not the wounds to his skin and tissue, but the wounds we have inflicted on other people. On the cross, Jesus was extending his ministry of healing. He had demonstrated himself as the healer par excellence. As he died, his blood, his life was made available for wound/injury healing for everyone, everywhere. There's a clear connection between Jesus' ministry and death, which are often separated in other views of the cross. The world, the flesh and the devil try to make wounds fester. Festering wounds in people's bodies, hearts, communities, nations are the work of evil, trying to hinder the work of God through Jesus. How much do we see this in our world, our news? The blood stops the forces of festering. The wounds are then healed gradually. Jesus' blood covers once and for all. Under the blood, the Holy Spirit works gradually to heal, repair, sanctify. The work of the Holy Spirit in cooperation with Jesus is seen to be integral. Other views of the cross don't see the Holy Spirit as integral to the process. The primary focus on the wounds we have inflicted, rather than on the rift in our relationship with God, which is a consequence of the wounds, is the same as the biblical focus in judgment on what people have done. Matthew 26, sheep and goat, Revelation 20, many other places. We're not judged for what we believe or how we've related to God. We're judged according to what we have done. This goes against one point of agreement about idolatry being the central problem in humanity between the two Toms. All of us have injured some people. That is our central problem to which we have to face up. Our good deeds are irrelevant. The common view that the good deeds outweigh the bad is like making a defense in court on a stabbing charge by saying, I've donated millions to charity. What else we have done isn't the point. Have we inflicted injury? Was it our responsibility? How are we going to put it right? Those are the central questions. We need Jesus to put it right. Heal the wounds we've inflicted by his blood shed on the cross. Idolatry can and does lead us to wounding others and thinking it's justified for the sake of all kinds of false gods. Idolatry is a malign influence, but the wounds which idolatry justifies are the core problem. Think someone walking by on the other side because their understanding of religious purity or of bad events being God's will or punishment trumps the need to help the injured traveller. This understanding answers the exact question, what does it mean that Christ died for our sins? Christ died to cover our sins, the wounds we've inflicted on others, like a scab covers a wound, ensuring that in the end the wound is healed. Christ's death, Christ's blood means that all sins are covered, ultimately healed. Tom Schreiner said, Christ died for me. He died in my place. He took the anger of God so that it doesn't come to me. This is answering a slightly different question. What does it mean that Christ died for me? Tom Schreiner's answer says, my sin caused God's wrath, but leaves me in a good place and my sins untouched. The primary focus on the wounds we've inflicted echoes the life review in near-death experiences. This review enables us to see and to feel all the wounds we've inflicted so that we can acknowledge responsibility for them and have them healed. Anyway, Roger, quite, as you said, quite a long email there. Really interesting theory, not one I've ever heard before. Now, whether that means you're a theological genius or you're a heretic, who knows? But I'd be interested to hear what people think about the idea that we could, taking this idea of the Kippur being a covering, that the atonement is really about a blood covering in this kind of almost metaphorically biological sense, that a scab covers a wound. Very interesting. Thank you for getting in touch. And because that was a long one, we'll have to leave some of the emails to another time. Thank you for being with me this week for Unbelievable. Thank you for being with me this year for Unbelievable. And I wish you a very happy new year for 2017 and all that it brings your way, including many more episodes of Unbelievable. Let me tell you what's coming up on the first Saturday of the new year.
You're unbelievable.
My friend, the atheist churchgoer. Sounds like a contradiction in terms. Well, Joe and Tom have been attending church for years now. Tom is not a Christian, though. He's an atheist, and he'll be talking about why he goes to church, what effect it has on him when he stands next to Joe, who's a Christian. When he lifts his hands in worship and praises God, what does Tom think about that? And what does Joe do with having a skeptical friend right next to him in the pew? Listen out next week for what should be a really interesting dialogue. Until then, have a great new year.